If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today.
Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread.
Hey everybody, welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. My name is Mr. X Stitch, and on today's episode I'm interviewing Kath Janes. The artist formerly known as Kraken Creations, Kath has a fantastic skill set in which she creates anatomical hand embroideries, dissections of humans, detailed shots that really make you marvel at the magnificence of how we are made. Kath's a fantastic person. She's been through an awful lot. Her journey's amazing, and it's been great to talk to her at this point when she's starting to put her name out there as a legit artist. She's an award-winning artist. She's been celebrated by the Society for Medical Illustration, and she's just a great person. It's a great interview. We talk all around the houses. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. If you like the show, please do leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. If you want to see more of Kath's work, you can see her on Instagram, links in the show notes. And finally, don't forget to subscribe to the Needle Exchange newsletter so you can catch up with all the gossip from my world as Mr. X Stitch and everything that I get up to. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks for being here. See you soon. So it's interesting for you then, because I wanted to ask you, I've got lots of questions, done a bit of research, but I wanted to ask you how you're adapting to being Kath Janes artist.
So far, great. It feels brilliant now. The process leading up to that decision, and that was really brutal. That was kind of staring the imposter syndrome in the face, which wasn't pretty. And I'm not saying I don't have imposter syndrome now. I absolutely do. You know, when you asked me to do this interview, I had a good couple of hours of, what's he want? Why does he want to talk to me? Why me? Why not somebody else? He knows so many good artists. I'm just shit. So I still go through that, but I'm better able to kind of talk myself down off it. But yeah, the run-up to that was really brutal because it made me kind of think about not what I wanted. I knew what I wanted, but not just how to get there, but was I worth getting there? God, that sounds very deep and dark, doesn't it?
No. It's good.
Do you think? So, sorry, I'm not making much sense there.
No, do you
think
that because
you spent... Like I say, I had to stare the monster in the face.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And the monster was like Kraken. And the thing is, you started out with an alter ego. And I'm someone who has an alter ego. You know, there's a difference between Mr. X Stitch and Jamie Chalmers. And that can be useful because Mr. X Stitch, I can like turn up the volume a bit and talk a bit more like this, you know, and be this guy. And I'm not really that guy, but that's, I think sometimes it provides a shield. And what you've done is you've established yourself as somebody who's an admirable, dare we say, award-winning artist. And now you're having to like peel away the armor that Kraken Creations gave you and just be like, here I am, warts and all.
Yeah, and it's scary to do that. You know, I always distinguish between two types of fear. There's one where you're right to be scared because there's a man coming at you with a knife. And there's one where you just need to buckle in, face it, and push through it. And it was that with, in terms of becoming an artist, the previous incarnation, the Kraken Creations thing, that was never really fully thought through. That was all kind of pieced together as I was recovering from a breakdown. And it was never fitted me brilliantly. But now that I see myself more as an anatomical artist, I could see it just didn't fit me at all. And in fact, it was kind of constraining me in terms of what I want to do and where I want to go. So I knew I had to kind of break out of it. And I guess, you know, I always describe these things to myself like childbirth. You know, it's a lot of shit and blood and guts and pain. But when you come out the other side, you've got something good to show for it. And so I kind of equated moving to my name as, you know, pushing a giant melon out of my fanny, essentially. Mentally, it was. Brilliant.
I think a lot of people can equate to that, particularly the male listeners. No, but it's true. It's true. And I mean, I wonder whether, do you think you came to a point where this is a naturally occurring transition? Because, you know, if you'd have decided early on that Kraken Creations wasn't a good fit, say 3 years ago, do you think you would have had the nerve to do it then? Or do you feel that you've got a surety in yourself now?
Yeah, I have. Absolutely. I've always loved doing my anatomical embroidery, and it was always a bit of an aside to everything else that I did. And as the last few years have gone on, I've really developed my self-belief in it. I absolutely believe in it. I've got imposter syndrome in virtually everything else, except my ability to stitch anatomy. I feel like my feet are absolutely on the ground with that. And that wasn't there 3 years ago. And it's really interesting that last year I had one of my reels on Instagram went viral. I got nearly 2 million views. And that was a really love-hate experience. And there were lots of things I absolutely hated about it. I didn't realise I climbed the wrong mountain until I was on top of the mountain and looking back. Equally, there were lots of really positive experiences, of course. And one of those was I had back-to-back commissions for a year. Almost every week to 2 weeks, there was a new commission. And that really forced me to be so immersed in anatomical embroidery that any doubts I had previously had gone. I just learned and I was challenged and I stitched them away. So yeah, I'm in a good place now, I think, to do it, a place where I wouldn't have been in a few years ago. So yeah, you're right.
I mean, that's a fascinating thing that you've just said there, that you realized you've been climbing the wrong mountain. Because I was going to ask you about that, because when something goes viral, for some people, you think that's the dream. I've had a thing go viral. But I mean, what was that like?
I feel really guilty for saying it was brutally hard, because a lot of people do chase the dream. And I was chasing the dream. I didn't have an idea that I wanted to go viral. But in terms of, you know, being seen and pushing my little business, you know, that's the gold standard, really, isn't it? And weirdly, it was one of those reels where I had no makeup on and I had 2 minutes to spare and I was arsing about in my shed. And it just kind of coincided with something that appeared in a magazine and it blew up from there. And it was exciting at first. And the work I got from it was great, but the stress of it was absolutely crucifying. And I've got ADHD, which means I struggle emotionally. I struggle with overwhelm. I can't prioritize and organize rationally sometimes. I do those things for my business, but it takes a massive amount of work. Suddenly, every morning, I get up and I look at my Instagram and there are thousands more views, which is great, but there are hundreds more messages and emails. And I'd gone from stitching for hours every day to spending virtually 4 hours a day doing emails and messages. And it was just massively overwhelming. And the amount of stress I went through was just appalling. And in the end, it kind of really took a physical toll. I think my reel went viral at the start of Feb last year. And I remember losing my mind a little bit in the June. Because it'd been just back-to-back emails, messages. And when you're an artist, people ask, can I commission something? And that's great. But I think what a lot of people don't realise is the commissioning process can take a little bit of time. I want to know what people want, what their ideas are, what I can incorporate. And that all takes a lot of discussion. So when you wake up every morning and you've got, say, 100 emails all asking for a commission, and that's the process you do with all of them, and then perhaps only a small percentage will say, yes, go ahead, it adds up to a lot of admin and overwhelm for somebody whose brain is already overwhelmed. I guess the silver lining was that being forced to do a year of back-to-back commissions, not forced, I mean, I said yes to those, that was partly climbing the wrong mountain too. It left zero space for any kind of artistic branching out, my own creativity.
Yeah,
it felt very much like embroider by numbers for a year, and I found that quite hard. So, you know, if you can get, if you want to go viral and you can cope with it, the work it comes off it, then go for it. That's great. But I don't think I'll ever chase going viral again. I just realised it wasn't for me, really. I want the engagement and I want to be seen, but I could have done with that level of attention spread out over a year rather than in the space of a couple of months.
Because you did go quite hard on the reels for a while there, didn't you? Was it on Instagram reels or was it a TikTok that went viral?
Instagram.
Yeah.
And I love doing them.
Do you still do them now? Do you still feel it? Or is it you're quite nonchalant about it?
I do them less consistently. I think it depends. When I'm in a truly creative space and I've got the time to stitch and I'm creating that more and more, then I'm really in the mood to do reels. I love doing them. I find them as an extension of my creativity. I get so many questions from people asking me everything from how did you fall into stitching anatomy to how do you, I don't know, scrape the viscera off a pig skull. I get so many questions. There's always lots of things to chat about on reels. And because I've been doing them for so long now, I can do them quite quickly. So I really enjoy doing them still. And I'm not going to stop doing them. I think I'm going to be less fussy over them like I used to be. Again, the viral reel was a case in point. I think it was the first reel I did where I looked like shit. I had no makeup. It took me 2 minutes and it just went berserk. So I'm more laid back about it and I'm better at them. So yeah, they're an extension of my creativity. I'm going to keep doing them, I think. That's the
thing. I find them really compelling. You're very charismatic, and I think that you wouldn't get that when you look at your work's beautiful, and we'll talk about that. But there's so much more to it. You're like a total package. And then I think also the other thing that you're quite fearless. Like if you spin back through your Insta to the start, you were doing lots of sweary things, you were doing lots of like dressmaking kind of things.
Yeah.
There was quite a lot of like attitude there.
Yeah.
And I think that fearlessness continues, but it's almost like you pivoted. And I feel like you've lots of people have asked you about your Bell's palsy. You've been quite open about talking about your postnatal depression. Yeah. I feel like you've formed into quite a sort of a good advocate for those things.
Oh, blimey. Hell, Spaz, I hope so. I love that you use the word fearless because I'm often shitting myself. But I've got that thing in my head where it's a fear that it's worth pushing through. You know, you kind of feel it and do it anyway. And with reels, when I started doing reels, somebody persuaded me to get on board and I was scared to show my face because my Bell's palsy. So again, I had to kind of face the monster there. I initially thought Instagram would be like Twitter. I'd put a reel on and I'd get 2,000 people say, "You ugly cow, get back in your shed. Don't show us your face again." That never happened once. And I guess I got braver as a result of that. In terms of things like my PND and PTSD and my breakdown, I've always been open about my mental health. I've never seen the benefit of being quiet about it. I've always improved health-wise when I've talked about it. Every time I mention it, I get a message from somebody saying, "Thank you for saying something." And in the end, that's who I am. If I kind of hit those things, I wouldn't be kind of fully out there. And I'm such an all or nothing kind of person. If I'm kind of half out there, then it's just not enough. So, you know, I think when I look, having this conversation now, when I look back, life is very much a series of looking the monster in the face and doing it anyway. And hoping nobody notices, really. But when they do, it's great. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they do. And I think people love you. I think that's what's great. I think that, and I mean, sometimes I think there's something to do with like textile arts, you know, that inherently brings out a kindness in people. We understand that it's a soft thing. We understand it's a natural thing and it generally isn't a very cynical thing, even though you can like swear and you can do all of that. The process is slow. It's mindful. And so I think that automatically clicks people into a more conscientious mode of thinking.
So then when you address some of the issues you address, people are in the good headspace in the first place. On Twitter, it's Wild West, you know what I mean? No one really gives a shit.
You're right. On Twitter, they'll pivot from shouting at Trump for his policies to shouting at you because you used the wrong sort of stitch. But on Instagram, it's very different. I think I like to think when people go there and they're scrolling, they've already built up some sort of feed where they love textile art. And you're right about that softness. I used to stitch in coffee shops and things. I don't do that now because I haven't got the time really. And every time I did it, it would start a conversation with somebody about their grandmother. And they'd always start the conversation with warmth and love. Oh, I remember my nana doing this. And I'd sit with her and they'd start going down kind of memory lane. And that's a conversation you're never really going to have with a stranger in any other way. So I think you're right. There is that kind of softness to it when people interact. And I know there are political blow-ups in the world of textile art sometimes, but I think generally people are all in that place where they want to appreciate the textile art. And hopefully don't kind of, you know, drag you all over the internet calling you a cow. That's what I'm hoping. It'll happen to me soon, I'm sure.
No, I think if it was going to happen, it would have happened already. Instead, they'll call you an award-winning anatomical illustrator. Let's talk about how you came to be. That's quite a long story, isn't it? Talk about it. Oh, there was a bright light and somebody slapped me.
That was this morning.
But no, I mean, because you started stitching relatively late, would you say?
Yes. I did a tiny bit of sewing at the end of my teens and I dropped it to go to university. I became a journalist. I was a freelance journalist on broadsheets for years. And then 15 years ago, I had my daughter. I had a massive breakdown. I had PND, PTSD. I was absolutely, batshit is the kind word for it. I was off my nut. And I had to check in journalism. I just couldn't go back to that level of, you know, chaos and deadlines. And it was as I was kind of recovering from my breakdown, I got to a stage where I needed some kind of structure to my day and something to do. And for some reason, I thought about sewing. Got a cheap sewing machine and I kind of went from there, stitched some bits and bobs. And, you know, it's the old story. You stitch some things, people like them. They say, will you make me one? You think, oh, this might be an idea for a shop, and off you go. So I did start doing that, I guess, about 10 years ago. I didn't embroider for a good few years after I'd started doing that stitching. It was all machine stitching. And one of the outcomes of the PND and the PTSD was my Bell's palsy, which got a lot worse. So I had a series of surgeries on it, and one went really badly wrong. I mean, Jesus, the word necrotic was used for the inside of my head. Yeah, that was pretty grim. So I had to spend quite a while in hospital. And I was really bored. And I asked my husband to bring in some threads and a needle and some fabric. And I just started, like, fancying embroidery. And I didn't want to do anything floral, all the traditional things that I already knew about. But I had seen a lot of images of the inside of heads and faces. And I knew straight stitches just felt like muscle fibers. And I started kind of noodling. I questioned it all. Is this weird? Am I a freak? Who the hell stitches anatomy? But there was something that just kind of captivated me and I kind of kept going. My facial surgeon saw the first piece I did. I showed him when I was halfway through it. And he got very excited, insisted he buy it off me. And it was like, I might be onto something. And off I went. So it's weird how, you know, mental ill health started me sewing. And then my Bell's palsy started me doing embroidery. And I often wonder if they were ways of me coming to terms with my health and understanding my health. Embroidery is such a slow process. And it can be so meditative. And it can give you the space to sit and just digest the things that are happening to you. And I think I found that really helpful at the start. And weirdly, now I'm doing these much bigger, more complex pieces. I'll often consider my own experiences, for example, of those organs while I'm stitching them. So, you know, breastfeeding when I was doing a breast, and my endometriosis in childbirth, doing the uterus, and my own mental health when I'm doing a brain. They just give me the space to kind of think, really. And I can't remember how that answer started or what your question was.
That's the point. And I think it's fascinating. I mean, do you think that your decision to go down the anatomical route, particularly in relation to faces, did that help you adapt to the Bell's palsy? Because it's not something that's gone away. And so you know, we all have to go through our own ways of going, right, this is my new normal.
Yeah. I think it has. That whole meditative process of stitching initially really helped me kind of come to terms with the outcome of one of the surgery that went wrong. In the first instance, it stopped me being bored. In a greater place than that, it made me kind of understand what was happening. Just looking at the anatomy helped me understand what was going on inside my head. Mm. And that's never really stopped. It's funny how the stitching has helped me in every step of the way. As I said earlier, even down to the reels. I knew I needed to do reels if I wanted people to see me, but I had to face my face, essentially, before I did. Yeah. So it's always been, I guess, a very gentle way of making me look at these things, but in my own time, rather than being told I have to do them. I'm very much a contrarian, and I like to do my own thing. So I guess these have all allowed me the space and time to kind of come to all these places where I've worked through them, really.
And then the beauty of your technique is that your stitching doesn't have to be particularly complicated. I think you've said before you only use like 3 or 4 different types of stitches most of the time.
Oh, geez, yeah. Sometimes I'd love to use more complex stitches, but I can't work out how they'd fit into anatomy. And it's really interesting. People often say, oh my God, it must be so complicated. And it's not. It's straight stitches, split stitches, and French knots. And that's it, essentially. And I use lots of shades, and, you know, the stitches can get quite complex in terms of sizes. I do, some stitches are single strands, perhaps 2 millimeters long, so it gets kind of into that granular detail. But that's just because I love falling down rabbit holes. But in terms of actually stitching, you don't need a complex kind of Bible of stitches in your head. You can do the most basic stitch you've got and make something with it. And I think that's one of the joys of it, that you can come up with something so complex from something most people can do, especially anyone who loves stitching or textile art. You can thread a needle, you can do some muscle fibers, and then you just grow from there, really.
Have you done any classes? Because obviously the techniques, you're heading into like silk shading territory with a specific like single stitch and all that kind of thing. Have you ever done any of those, or are you self-taught?
No, I'm self-taught. I'm completely self-taught, and I haven't done any. And I've got a long to-do list of things I'd like to achieve. And on there are things like courses and classes, and I've never really found the headspace to attack those goals properly. But now that I've kind of, you know, now that I see myself more as an artist and I'm giving myself way more time to create art, I'm hoping that will follow quite naturally. So that is the goal at some point. I don't even think it'll be this year, but it's something that's there on the horizon, tantalizing and calling me. I'll get there, I think. I hope I will.
So your year of doing all these commissions, it feels almost a bit like when the Beatles went to Hamburg, you know, and they're grinding it for a year or whatever, and then they come back and they start doing their own. I went to the Beatles exhibition not that long ago, and the thing that always blows my mind about the Beatles is their entire run was 7.5 years, all of that. You know, it's mind-melding, because there's people that take that long between albums, you know, and their creative throughput was ridiculous.
They were blasting through it.
Yeah, like, and every 6 months, new album, tour, and all that kind of things. The question I was going to ask is, now that you're affording yourself the time to explore your own creative path again, where's that going? Because you've ground out doing these things, doing eyeballs, and, you know, the things, and part of that has been necessity. So now you're like, if the foot's off, where are you going with it?
Penury, I expect. Because the money's going to stop coming in as well. But that's okay. I'm kind of embracing that as much as I can. I've got an idea to do an exhibition. Saying those words out loud is quite a big thing for me. And the plans so far are still in a notebook. But I've got some concepts and some ideas, and I'm working through them and fleshing them out. Got no idea where the exhibition would be, you know, what it would look like, essentially. But I'm just... I don't feel like I can work out any of that until I've got a concept that I'm absolutely bang on about. So I've got several little ideas and I'm weaving them together. And that's a very new process. I often say on Instagram, I'm very kind of, I feel very isolated artistically. And I feel like I'm often reinventing the wheel. And I feel a little bit like that in the idea of creating an exhibition. It's like I'm starting from scratch. I've got nobody to ask. So I'm just feeling it all out. But it's nice to have the space to do that and the creative belief to think I can do that. and to just keep taking those little steps towards it. So that's the goal for the next kind of couple of years, as well as doing, if anyone sends me an interesting commission, of course, I'll do it. But that's the goal. That's the big goal at the moment, an exhibition.
As an aside, you're not alone. So, you know, feel free to use me as a sounding board or whatever.
Thank you, Jamie.
I've curated a few bits and pieces. You know, there's some mechanics and stuff. But I think probably the big thing to address is, yeah, what's the story you're going to tell with that exhibition?
Yeah. I suspect what I'm planning to cover are some of the things we've mentioned. I mean, it'll be anatomical, but it'll be addressing my PND, my PTSD, perhaps my Bell's palsy, stitching in terms of health, how it impacts on that. But I suspect it's going to be quite dark as well, because there's a lot of dark shit in there. So that's what I want to play with, really, is the dark and the light. I'd hate to have an exhibition that's just about, you know, the joys of stitching. I want it to reflect also the times I kind of stitched my way out of walking into a road. So I'm trying to kind of grapple with all these ideas and make them in one coherent kind of form. So it's quite interesting.
Yourself.
I'm quite enjoying the process at the moment.
Yeah. No, it sounds really cool. It sounds like it's a naturally occurring evolution as well, which I think is always quite a satisfying thing. Because these ideas do kind of creep up, don't they? And they sort of like weedle their way to the front. You've probably done a stitchery of how the mass of that happens, or the science or whatever. So I was going to ask you about your business, if that's all right, in as much as, because I think it's one thing to say you're an artist, and every now and again you get that person who gets commissions for like $100,000 a pop or whatever. But for most of us, it's a bit of a grind. And I just wondered how your business is formed.
Jeez, grind.
Because I know it's something that you're not, you don't love it. Partly because of the ADHD, but then also, and this is a thing that none of us realize, is suddenly, you know, I started doing cross stitch and now I do a magazine, so I have to be able to do marketing, and I have to do accounts, and you have to do this, and you, do you know what I mean? So you have to do everything, and no one ever tells you that, really. So
no, I've worked for myself for 18-19 years as a freelance journalist. I got used to the amount of time it took to write a piece and all the ancillary stuff, the admin and the accounts and the pitching. So I've always known that when you work for yourself, you're not just doing 100% of the time the thing that you love. In terms of embroidering, that's become really difficult to manage. And I think because there is a level of marketing that wasn't involved as a freelance journalist, I didn't need an Instagram account or anything. I just needed to be known by editors. No, it's very different. You have to be really good at marketing. I often wail to my poor beleaguered husband. Most people get paid a full-time salary to do the level of marketing I'm trying to do. And, you know, then you get to the accounts, which I'm lucky enough to hand to him because he's an accountant, bless him. But then there's the admin and the commissions and the emails. And that's been an ongoing battle. I think even last week I was in tears at one point because we updated my website. My website designer did all the website work. But the knock-on effect, going into the back end of all my social media platforms, changing the logos, the emails, the names, and because I'm ADHD, it takes me way longer. You could probably give the entire thing to a 15-year-old and they'd do it in an hour. And it took me a week. And I was in tears. So I always find that a real struggle. And that's one of the reasons I've kind of gone, come over to see myself as an artist, because I really wanted to put at the center of everything my creativity. Oftentimes in the past, I felt like an administrator who sometimes did art, and I just knew that had to change. So I'm learning to say no to things. I'm trying to focus on specific things I want to achieve and then just saying no to the stuff that's on the side. But when you work for yourself and you fall down a rabbit hole like I do in terms of, you know, embroidering as a giant rabbit hole, there are so many things I want to achieve. It's quite hard to put those on the back burner. My ADHD means I want to do everything right now. I find it really hard to say, I'd like to achieve this. I'll look at it in 6 months' time. So my to-do list can be absolutely endless, and I think I have to cram that into every week. So it's all about, you know, logistically saying to others, no, I can't do that. And then saying to myself, okay, Janesy, step the hell back. What's logical? What can you do? I'm kind of still negotiating all of that, but it's an ongoing struggle. And I think with my ADHD, because it's easy to get carried away, I kind of forget sometimes how bad the imbalance can be until I'm kind of in tears again. So I'm getting better, thank God. Mm. But it is a weekly battle to remind myself of what I want and to kind of stick to that and not get swept away with all, like I say, all the ancillary stuff. This week's been a great week. I've stitched for a solid 4 days and I've loved it. So I'm trying to cling on to that feeling. So when I do my to-do list later today for next week, I'll remember loads of stitching. Don't just become an admin assistant with a bit of art on the side.
Do you batch things? Do you do things in batches?
Oh, I try. Yeah, Fridays now are often my admin days, where I save up all my emails to do at the end of the week, so I can just focus on those. I used to try batch things like marketing and social media, and that was just crap, because I often, when I say I work emotionally, I don't mean erratically. If I get an idea for something that I think is going to go down really well, say on Instagram, I want to do it now. I don't want to put it in the diary to do in a month's time, because the feeling will have gone and the enthusiasm will have gone. So I do try to batch things, but in creative terms, I just go with it when it happens, because you can't replicate that enthusiasm when you're a bit tired and you're not in the mood. And as you said, I think it kind of earlier about how I appear on Instagram. I mean, charismatic is a word you need to tell to my psychiatrist. He'll laugh at that. But I think that enthusiasm comes across. You can tell when somebody's done something by rote because they have to.
Yeah.
And when they've done it because they're enjoying it. So I try and capture that feeling. And batching sometimes, other times just go with the flow.
I'm going to give you one of my best tool tips, if I may. There's a tool called Text Expander. I think it's available on Mac. I'm a Windows guy. And it's an app. And basically what it means is if you say the same thing in emails over and over again, you can turn them into like little short codes to expand things. So, for instance, the list of questions, the intro that I sent to you, to make that happen, I typed colon NXHI and it expanded into all of that because I've taken the time to do it. Anytime I have to share a web link for the magazine, I've got a little code for that. And what you do is you make a little code of something you wouldn't normally type. So I put a colon, and if I put XS01, that's the link to the page that sells the first issue of my mag. If I put XXI01, it's a Dropbox link to my mag. If I type in TFYAE, it expands to thank you for your email. Sorry if it's taken a long time to respond. So if you say the same things over and over again, you can get Text Expander, you can put it in, you can format it, and then you can just set these short codes up and it'll just save you time.
Oh my God, I need that.
Be really long. Yeah.
I need that.
Just look it up. It's free to download. I don't think it costs very much.
Just look it up
because honestly, it is a bit of a game changer because there's so many things I say over and over again and now I've just got them as little short codes and you just bang them out. And it can be really quite complex stuff, you know, paragraphs, formatting, all of that sort of stuff. So.
Oh God, that's my brilliant. Gift to you. That's a top tip. Thank you. If I do ever win another award, I'll say you helped me by giving me the time to stitch.
I gave you an extra 5 minutes.
Give you
there.
Commission.
What other makers do you admire? Who do you look at and think, God, they're good?
Oh, Jester Walls is absolutely at the top. Absolutely by a freaking mile. I'm lucky enough to consider her a friend. But I love her work. I mean, you know those artists when you're scrolling on Instagram and you stop and you pinch out because you want to see what they've done and how they've done it. She's one of those. Mm. And I always want to see how, you know, and a couple of times I said, how have you done this and how have you done that? And she's just so laid back about it all. And apart from the embroidery, she's so self-assured in her work, in her belief in herself as an artist. It's just... You know, there are times, and I've told her this, and we laugh. There are times I'm stitching, I'm fucking something up, and I'm thinking, okay, what would Jess do? How would Jess tackle this? And it just makes me kind of stop and think, okay, stop panicking over the wrong stitches. Just fucking think about it. Let me think. There's somebody called Lucy Peacocks and Pine Cones, who, again, when I see her work on Instagram, I stop and pinch it out. She's just the queen of stitching light on glass. She does glass decanters and glass bottles and glasses. And it's just fantastic. I could gaze at her work for hours. And when I'm stitching anatomy, I think, you know, how would she capture the light? Could I ever do that? I can't work out. It's like witchcraft. Hannie Newton, I love. She does gold work in these lovely organic lines, and that's another thing that always stops me in my tracks. And there's a medical illustrator called Peter M. Lawrence, whose work is just staggering. It's all digital, but the level of detail in the anatomy and the views, the anatomical views he creates, which I've not seen before, I suspect just because I'm an amateur anatomy enthusiast, again, always stop me in my tracks. So they are the four who don't just stop me, but make me think about my own work and how I can push it and challenge it and get better. So, yeah, I'd say they are my four big followers, really, all on Instagram.
That'd be a heck of a dinner party if you got them all in the same room together. OMG.
I would tie them up and I would interrogate them all about how they do it and not let them go until they told me.
Because this is a funny thing. So you've got your feet now in two camps. You've got your respectable embroidery artist, but you're also like in the medical illustration zone, and that's like an entirely another realm, isn't it? It's a different discipline altogether, really.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I love it. I love, as I said earlier, I'm quite the contrarian. So I love being somewhere so niche and I love being different. Equally, it's quite a lonely place to be sometimes because it is so, it's not very well populated. The awards I won last year were from the Institute of Medical Illustrators. I'm an affiliate member there. And, you know, in terms of medical illustration, so much of that is now done. I say it's either photography or it's digital. So in terms of textile art, that's very niche. And I'm very much aware that in terms of, you know, in embroidery, what I do is very niche. And it's a love-hate thing. Equally, most of the time I love it. I'd say 80% of the time I love that. 20% of the time it feels a little bit lonely and I'm like, oh, shit, where am I going? But I'm kind of working it out as I go along. It was never the plan to do something in such a niche area. It's just kind of grown. And now that I'm here, there's no way I'm kind of turning around and leaving again. So the only way is forward, really, see where it takes me.
Because it strikes me as interesting because back in the day, the medical illustration was the way people understood bodies, right? They cut them open, they drew what they looked at. Now, I guess we've got all this hyper brilliant imaging technology, which has kind of taken the art away from it. And yet you're proactively pointing in the opposite direction. You're always going like ultra analog with this. So I'd imagine there's a lot of people who really appreciate that, right?
I love that, ultra analog. Oh my God, I hadn't thought of it like that. And I love it. Thank you. I'm happy being analog. It's really interesting that a lot of medical settings now use analog art to engage with patients. You know, there are several hospitals locally I'd like to work with where they routinely do exhibitions of art, not necessarily anatomical, but they put it in places where, you know, the patients are wandering around, they can see it, there's a bit of beauty, there's something interesting. And I think, you know, anatomy absolutely has a place there. One of the things I love doing with anatomical art is, or anatomical embroidery, is taking an image most people would be horrified by and trying to make something beautiful with it. And I've often found because it's embroidery, people immediately kind of go towards it because they want to see the stitches and how it's done. Yeah. And the secondary response is, oh, shit, it's a spleen. Oh, it's a bit of brain. So it kind of softens their interaction with the human body almost. And I love kind of harnessing that. I love playing with that and challenging people. You know, if I were to walk up to a random human being with one of the images from one of my dissection books, they'd probably, I don't know, throw up or hit me. But you stitch it and they start engaging with it. So I think there's absolutely room for that in terms of, you know, engaging with patients, perhaps in terms of understanding how the body works in order to give somebody a heart bypass. You really do need high-tech digital images. I absolutely get that. But medical professionals aren't the only people interacting with medicine. So it's about kind of going towards everyone else as well, really. Of course, my work is most often bought by medical professionals, which is lovely because they love the accuracy of it. But the medical world is quite big when you think of it. We all go to GPs, we all sit in waiting rooms, we all look at notice boards while we're waiting. They've all got images on them. There's no reason why they need to be digital, digital kind of flat images. They can be beautiful ones as well. So that's what I'm trying to achieve, really, is that beauty in medicine thing.
Why do you think we get grossed out by it?
You know what? I think a lot of us are taught to be grossed out by it.
I think, and I
guess at some level it's a primal thing. If you can see our intestines, you're probably going to die. So you don't want to see your intestines. And I absolutely get that. Of course I do.
Yeah.
But I think we're often taught, oftentimes when we're younger, the only time we see the inner workings of the human body is in a slasher film in the cinema. And that's because there's a guy coming at you with a knife. So none of these situations are ones you actually want to be in, are they? They all signal death. And so it's easy to get to a place where you just want to see inside the human body. But there's just so much wonder inside the human body. And I understand why people get scared of it, but equally, I find it really weird to be scared of the thing. To be scared of the reason why you're here, being scared.
Yeah.
If that sounds... You know, you're scared because you're alive. You're alive because your heart is beating, your kidneys are functioning, you took a shit this morning. That's all anatomy. So even if you're never going to go rooting through a body like I want to, at least kind of appreciate what it is. I know several people who are so scared of their bodies, they won't even go to the doctor when they're ill. And I've known a couple who've become almost, one was terminal and one wasn't as a result. And that just makes me a bit like insane. I'm like, you just get to know your body. So I think it's about showing the body to people at a young age when it's not all about slasher films and death. It's about appreciating what it is, really.
My daughters have, you know, every now and again we might see a pigeon on the road that's been hit by a car or whatever. And they're just fascinated by it because they haven't had the conditioning to say it's a bit gross.
Yes, that's exactly it. I think you're right.
Do you find that your use of false colour then helps get over those barriers as well? Because it doesn't quite look as icky.
Yeah, I think it helps. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, false colour is used traditionally in medical illustration because otherwise everything is a greyish pink and you can't see the nerves from the vessel, blood vessels. And I think that does help. That kind of softens it. It's not so... It's not as kind of gory, for want of a better term, as looking at an image of a dissected body. So I absolutely do think that helps. And I use a lot of false colour. I'm trying to go towards using more realistic shades now. But even then, I think the fact that it's textile art and it's embroidered, you know, however much I want to try and make realistic textures and to capture light, it's never going to be the same, I suspect, as light actually bouncing off a liver in real life. So there's almost like that just little time to breathe between seeing it and knowing what it is. And I think that does kind of, I think that helps when people look at it. Absolutely. But yeah, false colour's great. It's, it means you can kind of be that much more kind of creative in some ways. And in terms of medical illustration, false colour's very important.
Do you have a favourite part of the body?
Oh, it's got to be female anatomy. And I think that's because so many of my experiences in life are because of my female anatomy. I mean, all the life-changing shit has been down to that. And I don't just mean in terms of periods. I had endometriosis for, I think, nearly 30 years before I accidentally got pregnant. Oh, my God. And that was all... That sparked the PND and the PTSD and then the breakdown, which was life-threatening. And it's that weird thing where my female anatomy has kind of conspired against me almost. Not just medically, but in terms of how I live my life as a woman. You know, sexual harassment on the streets or the fact I haven't been paid equally ever when I worked for anyone else. These things, even when I go for a walk, you know, I walk in really quiet places because I enjoy it. And even then, there'll always be somebody to say, be careful, you're a woman on your own. So my female anatomy is central to everything I've done, whether I've liked it or not. And when I stitch it, I get to understand it better and I love it even more. And it always makes me think about my own experiences. So it's just, it's wonderful to kind of get into the nitty gritty of all of that. One of the things, one of the commissions I did, I think it was the year before last, a woman asked me to stitch her, well, not stitch her cervix, stitch a cervix, because she'd had a cancer scare and she'd had to have hers removed. And she said, having a cervix on a hoop with the words, I miss you, would help her come to terms with the fact she no longer had her cervix. And she kind of summed it up, really. It's one of those things where I'd be stitching a breast and I'd be thinking about the times breastfeeding was great and the times I cried at 3 a.m. because I wanted to walk into a road. And it, as ever, it's that kind of healing process. So yeah, female anatomy is the short answer, and that's why.
Yeah, nice. Now I'm going to ask you, well, I did send you my questions before and there were three, what are your favorite things? So I think these are quite, it's just a completely left field direction for a minute, but I feel like it's worth it. So do you have a favorite film?
Oh, Jaws. It's a cliche.
In fact, you've got the blooming poster up behind you. I can see it there.
I've got a poster. I can see three posters here on my wall. I've got a mug. I've got all sorts of bits and bobs. I've got a couple of T-shirts. I don't know what it is.
Why
that
do you
film
love
I got.
It?
Oh, my word. I think it's human frailty. And it's, looking back at this conversation, perhaps it's, oh, shit, that's weird, isn't it? That thing of facing your fear, you're shitting yourself and you don't want to do it, but you know you've got to do it. And that's what happens in the film, isn't it, with the police chief. He hates water. He shit scared the shark. He knows he has to get in the water and face the shark. And what I love is that he does that with human frailty. He doesn't do it in the Tom Cruise way, where he kind of becomes this macho superhero as he's doing it. He's shitting himself until the bitter end, and it works out well. And that's what I love about it. And of course, it's all the great acting, and I know all the story behind the film, but that's essentially the joy of it. I always feel disconnected. I always feel connected to the chief because he always looks like a human. And it's always stuck with me, and it's always been one of my favourite film, and whenever it's on TV, I'll always like record it and stop and watch it. I just love that film. So
I love that there's that thing, and I think it encapsulates what you were just saying. You know, there's that thing where Spielberg was the first person to do it, where he like zooms in and pulls back at the same time, like that thing. Yeah. That's the exact moment you're talking about, where suddenly you're like, holy shit, whoop, yeah, I've got to do this thing.
Yeah, yeah, I can't avoid it anymore. And if I do, for some reason, I'll be a lesser person. It's really weird. I started going to Ibiza on my own, a married and a daughter, but it's a long story. But I go clubbing on my own to Ibiza every year now. And I shit my pants every time because I'm going on my own. And I do it anyway because I know I'd be a better person. I'll have a great time. I'm doing what I want to do. I'll come back kind of, you know, emotionally richer and stronger. And I'm not suggesting I'm like a police chief chasing a shark, but I guess you've made me think it's a similar thing where you look at the fear and you know you've got to run towards the fire rather than away from it. And I guess that's why I kind of like that film.
I used to be involved in the roller derby, and the captain of our team always used to say there's no physiological difference between fear and excitement. It's like the butterflies are the same. It's just the way you look at them that's different. So maybe you just get really freaking excited about Ibiza.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I am. I always do, and I'm always shitting myself, but I know it's worth pushing through it. And you, I think it's often about the way you frame it, isn't it? So, excitement rather than fear. I think it's a good way to get through life, really.
Favourite book?
Oh, The Mosquito Coast by Paul Theroux. I freaking love that book. Shit. I've got a copy that's ancient, and it's held together by sticky tape, and I would rather die than buy a new one. I just love the way it's held together now. It's about a guy called Ali Fox, an inventor in the US, increasingly sick of living in the US. You know, he thinks everyone's being kind of screwed over, essentially. And he's got this idea to build an ice machine. He goes to Central America with his family, literally to the middle of the jungle. You know, he buys a tiny plot of jungle land from somebody and they go and live there. And it just becomes this massive. It starts out like the dream. You know, you're creating your own little utopia and look, we can grow vines and all this magical stuff. And he eventually does to the jungle and the people who live there what America did to him. And it's just the most catastrophic ending. It's so frigging dark. It's just great. And it's a film. It was turned into a film with Harrison Ford as Ali Fox, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great shit. And again, I think I just love the human frailty. And I love being reminded that sometimes it goes to shit and that you can be so sure of what you believe that you can't see the shadows coming at you that are actually worth looking at. It always makes me really kind of stop and think. So again, it's human frailty. Perhaps I should have been a therapist rather than a stitcher.
There's a theme. I think you are. And that Paul Theroux, Louis Theroux's dad, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Justin Theroux is his cousin.
And all that.
So, I don't get on with any other of his books, oddly, but that book is just like my frigging Bible. I love it.
And then favourite album?
Oh, well, this is going to sound a bit weird. I haven't got one. Oh, I think, in the 80s, I just said something by Duran Duran.
Right. Because I was going to ask you whether when you're stitching, do you stitch in silence? Do you listen to anything? Do you have any noise on the background or anything?
Yeah, I listen. There's a couple of podcasts I listen to. But I'm really into house and trance. So I'll often, I usually play house when I stitch because trance makes me want to get up and move. And I can't, it's like having my freaking feet chained together. I can't cope with it. So I tend to put more kind of house on. So, rather than an album, I kind of scavenge all the house and trance I can find and kind of have these long playlists, really. But, they keep me, I've got several playlists, one for when I need to be cool and one for when I need to stitch and when I want to move and one for when I'm doing my admin. So yeah, I'm a big scavenger, really, rather than one album. I guess there's one album, Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, is the only music my husband and I can possibly agree on. And in the 80s, I just said things like Aha and Duran Duran, but the 80s was a long time ago now.
It was a long time ago. Our caravan's got a CD player. And so recently I've been hunting down old copies of Now That's What I Call Music compilations because you can get them for like 50p on CD.
Oh my God. Right, you know what? There. I remember buying the first Now That's What I Call Music. The first one. That's how freaking old
I am. With
the
pig on the front cover.
Yeah.
Now That's What I Call Music 4 is my personal favourite. I've got it on vinyl because it's got some real classics like Dead and Alive and Duran Duran, View to a Kill. I'm right in the zone there. Also, what was I going to say? So on YouTube, there's a channel called Flavor Trip, and it's these two happy-go-lucky 20-somethings who DJ like house music, but it's kind of sometimes it's soulful house, sometimes it's jazzy house, and they also do it in quite nice locations, and they cook at the same time. So that's quite nice to listen to.
Dream.
Yeah, they bloody are. So annoying. They haven't got kids, clearly. And then also, I listen to Mixcloud quite a lot, which is a good streaming platform where you can just select mixes by categories and you can kind of learn. One thing leads to another. So you might start off with a certain genre, like Soulful House or something like that, and you'll find certain people DJing certain things. But I've got quite a selection now. Like, do you know Wayne Hemingway, the Red or Dead designer?
Yeah.
He puts out mixes on there, and sometimes it's Northern Soul and sometimes it's Yacht Rock or whatever. But there's loads of people that are quite eclectic in their tastes. Love a bit of Steely Dan. It's like one of the only CDs in my car at the moment. So I find that quite a good one as well, because, again, it's almost like having a radio station. People will put out weekly shows, but it's just mixes that sort of save you the kerfuffle of having to choose them or whatever. So that's definitely
I love that idea. I've made a note of those. I'm going to try them. And I think that's the thing. The way we listen to music now has changed so much. I noticed my daughter, she's 15, and she gets excited when there's a new Taylor Swift album or, Metallica have got a new album, she gets excited. And I'm just not that person anymore because I'm kind of gathering bits from everywhere. I guess that's how we listen to music these days, really, isn't it? So I'm totally going to look at those. Thank you, Gene.
Yeah, I find it sort of goes a little bit full circle as well because I've got a record player and I've built up a little bit of a clip. I've probably got 100 albums or something, nothing special. But at the same time, that makes you go the other way and makes you consider albums. So for me, I quite like early Elton John or a bit of Cat Stevens. Like the stuff I want to listen to as an album is very different to the stuff I want to listen to when I'm working, because it's like trying to find those collections. And again, sometimes just a cheap compilation like a Now That's What I Call Music, because you can just dive through a bit of nostalgia in quick succession. But something like Rumours, or there's a few albums that we've got. Do you know one of my favorite albums is All the Best by Paul McCartney, which pretty much covers his greatest hits from leaving the Beatles up until about the mid 80s. But it's got Rupert and the Frog chorus, but then he's also got loads of Wings on it and stuff like that.
And I've listened to that day in, day out, that album. It's really sound.
Oh, I must say, there's an album. I've got Talk Talk's Greatest Hits, which I absolutely frigging love. And that takes me right back to that time period. It's like kind of, it's like time travelling, isn't it, really?
Definitely.
I'm going left field a little bit, off track a bit, but me and my daughter watched Stranger Things. And there was a moment in one of those eps where they played the first couple of bars of a Journey song. And geez, Jamie, I sobbed. They didn't even get to the words. It like opened a portal in my head that took me right back 30 years to a place and a time. So yeah, it's great when you're not working and you've got the chance to stop and kind of go down those little paths, I guess, isn't it? I think we all need more of that rather than just like picking at things.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Do you have any other crafty pursuits?
Let me think. I never.
You like a bit of gardening, really. I believe.
Oh, I love gardening. Shit. I love gardening. I was a really keen gardener until I got pregnant, and I kind of stopped after about being 5 months gone because I couldn't get into the borders properly. And then with the PTSD and PND, I kind of took the greenhouse down. I just couldn't do anything. Didn't go in the garden for about, 10 years. And in the last few years, I've kind of started going back in there again, and it's looking great at the moment, and I just love it. I just love it. It's what I do every morning. I wander around the garden. It's what I do every evening. It's the last thing I see, essentially, apart from my loved ones. And I'll usually go in there in between times, and I work in there every day. And I used to think that was just kind of hard, like just cardio, like exercise, but it's not. It's so creative, and I spend so much time with seed catalogues and thinking, okay, what colour cornflower do I want? Would I put it next to this kind of plant or that? And I love the creative aspect, and I love how absorbing it is as well. And because we've got a relatively big garden, my family call me like a beaver. I've always got bits of wood scavenged from skips. And when I go on my country walks, I come home with these branches. I can't get in the car. I've got piles of those. So I'm always kind of getting the power tools out and making, you know, little things like bird boxes, gates, building arches. And it's one of those nice things where, because it's my garden, it doesn't have to be perfect. I'm not putting it on Instagram particularly for anyone to see unless I love the way it looks. I can just arse about with nails and screws and power tools. And I love the process, even if the end result looks a bit shit. So I do a lot of that stuff. And even if I'm not physically doing it, I'm planning it. It's like I've got this endless kind of creative thing going on in my head, and it needs some sort of output, or I feel like I'm going to go a bit bananas. So yeah, I say power tools and gardening are the biggest creative pursuits, really.
I think sometimes with gardening, people don't always realize that you're in negotiation the whole time. It's always, it's a battle, isn't it? It's a war going on that you have to deal with and stuff, but the rewards are totally
exactly
worth.
The times it's great, and there's times you feel like you're being overwhelmed by shit. But again, that's the kind of the to and fro of it. It's like a conversation almost, isn't it? Like, say, a war, battle.
Question. So you do anatomical embroidery and you love gardening. When are you going to start doing the proper botanical embroidery then? Like proper dissections and all of that sort of
stuff. Proper botanical embroidery? No, I don't think I ever will.
Do you not? Because you said at the start, you were just like, I wasn't really into flowers and all of that sort of stuff. But then I'm thinking there is a whole subgenre, isn't there, of like botanical illustration for the same kind of scientific purposes.
I think it just doesn't grab me in the way that human anatomy does. I could stitch it and it wouldn't be the end of the world, but it doesn't make me jump out of bed in the morning in the way like a spleen will, for example.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't appreciate plants. I mean, you know, every day on Instagram at the moment, I'm putting something on, but look at this that's opened in the garden. Look at the light on this petal. I love that. But there's just something, I get that. I put my teeth in it. You know, like a baby's chubby little legs, you want to go, whoa. That's what anatomy does. You just want to squish it. And I think I love that feeling that much. So even if I like other things, they don't give me that feeling. So I'm kind of going with that, whoa, squishy feeling. Does that translate squishy? Yeah.
No, I can dig it. Anybody who's had kids knows what you're on about there, of course.
Those little thighs.
In a way, I think I've run out of questions now. That's me being brutally honest. I think we've covered much everything. I was going to say, where can people find you online?
Let me think. I've got to think this now because it's all a bit new. I'm at kathjanes.com online. That's my website. And on the social media platforms I am on, let me think, there's only a, yeah, I'm Kath Janes Anatomy, and that's it. I've gone
and then
from...
let's talk about your newsletter.
Hot off the hoop.
Thank you, Jamie,
for doing my job for me. You should have gone into marketing. Yeah, this is hot off the hoop. So if people go to kathjanes.com, there's a little pop-up box there. They can go to Hot Off the Hoop. That's my monthly newsletter where I essentially spill my guts about what I do in the shed. I mean, I show a lot of stuff on Instagram, but it's not... it's all, you know, pics and updates and how I do things. But I really get into the filthy, grimy dirt of it in my newsletter. The actual artistic processes, and I'm very honest about it. When I'm having a, when things are going really well and when things are going really, really shit. So, you know, over the last few months, my hot off the hoops, I've included everything from I'm going to enter these awards, I'm really proud of this piece, to I've just cried for 3 weeks because I'm on the wrong form of HRT. So it's the whole thing. I've become really sick of seeing these kind of glitzy, perfect images of makers at their beautiful lit tables with the sun streaming in and, you know, the perfect terrier sitting next to them on the rug. And I'm trying to say, that's lovely. But for a lot of women, a lot of makers, men and women, it's just not like that. It can just be shit sometimes, and I want to show people that. Just because I think it brings them in. I think people identify more, don't they? I certainly identify more with artists when they're honest about how things are going for them. I identify much less with people who've always got perfectly curated studios and, you know, where the scissors pot looks lovely, but it also looks like it's never fucking used. So it's where people go to kind of see right inside my brain. And luckily, people really like it. And we have a great conversation. It's a great community. I always ask lots of questions. Everyone gets back to me. We chat. I know what they are doing. They know what I'm doing. So it's like a little community, really. So sorry, that was a very long answer to...
No, I love it. I love it because I'm a big fan. I think email newsletters are the best thing. I think they're better than social. And I think, I'm pretty sure I've subscribed to yours. If I haven't, I'm going to blooming do it in a second. But I think I did.
Yeah, if you
I think when
you
I saw it, I was just like, this is going to be a good one. I was like, of all the newsletters, this one's going to be a corker. That's good. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, my giddy aunt. Let me think. I think we've covered most things, really, haven't we? I've got nothing kind of burning, except if you ever do see me do an exhibition, you know, come and visit. Share
it. Oh, Jesus Christ, it'll be amazing.
Tell everyone
honestly,
that, you
I
know,
think
I'm
you
not
need
just
to...
a mad little woman in a shed.
I think you need to have a word with someone like the Wellcome Institute to get some sponsorship for that sort of thing. Because, you know, in the same way as... It was controversial, but you know the guy that, like, plasticized people and then would do dissections?
Yeah.
I can't remember that guy. But, you know, yours is... It's akin to that. It's an opportunity for people to... reconsider the way we're built and look at it in a way that it refreshes their perspective. And I think that any of your science organizations will appreciate, well, they are appreciating them already, you know, but I think your exhibition, when it happens and when you work out and when it ends up being called A Look Inside Cass, and it turns out it's largely your anatomy, but it's also your psychology or whatever. I think it's going to be amazing. So.
Yeah, come look at my cervix. It's lovely. I think that's the thing now that I'm doing. Now that I'm focusing on being an artist, I'll have more time to kind of chase these things and start forging links with, say, the Wellcome Trust and other organisations where I can kind of display my work. Weirdly, up until now, my nose has been so close to the grindstone, I could never see to the horizon. So that's what I'm finally doing, really, is looking at the horizon and... you know, trying to run for something. So, and if everybody wants to sign up to Hot Off the Hoop, you know, they can see in my shed, they can see what I'm working on, what's gone wrong, what's gone right, and whether the HRT is working. I mean, I don't know what
anyone
else could want.
There will be
links
in all
really.
The show notes for all of that. Have no fear. Well, no, thank you for your time. I'm really glad to be at this turning point for you.
Yeah, tipping.
Because I think now that you're out as an artist, I think it's exciting times. And, you know, it's been a pleasure watching you evolve over the years already. So Christ only knows what's going to happen next.
Oh, Jamie, thank you. I mean, you know, a lot of people see me as like the embroidery version of Burke and Hare when I'm dissecting things in my shed. So I could do this next podcast from prison or something. We really don't know, do we? But it'll be interesting, whatever happens.
Whatever happens. Cool. Thank you. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.